Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to The Game, the football podcast from The Times. As you might not have guessed, I'm not Gab Marcotti, but Alison Rudd. I said I'd rather be with my stamp collection, but they tempted me with a stellar lineup of guests who will share their views on a fascinating weekend of football. So, a welcome to former Arsenal and West Ham player Stuart Robson, WIFF-WAF champion and Times writer Matthew Syed, and, making his debut on The Game, Times executive editor and think tank Danny Finkelstein. Later we'll discuss appropriate wearing of pre-match t-shirts and related weighty issues, but let's start at White Hart Lane. Spurs, well, Chelsea started the better team, then Spurs remembered that they were at home and were supposed to be attacking, and then Chelsea remembered that they were champions of Europe. Was it a case of too much grudge from Spurs' point of view, Stuart?
No, I think they tried very hard. The trouble that they didn't have Bale in the side. You know, he's a player that would have been ideal for the situation. When I was previewing the game beforehand, I was talking about if Chelsea can contain Tottenham's wide players who have been excellent so far, Lennon and Bale, they'd have the key to winning the game. Bale not playing, it meant that there wasn't so much penetration down that left-hand side. Dempsey was playing and trying to come in on that into his right foot. But the other player they were missing was Dembele. And, you know, Dembele has been the real inspiration for them in that midfield area. And without those two players, I thought it was difficult for Spurs to dominate the game.
That was the build-up. Oh my goodness, there's no Dembele and no Bale. In terms of squad terms, they have an amazing squad. Danny, do you agree with me? I felt they should be able to absorb that relatively easily.
They should. There's no statistical reason why Spurs are worse in their squad than other teams. Yes, it's true they have an injury rate, but the average injury rate's about 6%. If you have a small variation, you have to remember that other sides have that too. On this question of grudges, there's absolutely no evidence of grudges in any history of the Premier League. There's no statistical significance to grudge matches, so I doubt very much that was the result in this game. It, basically, Chelsea were mild favourites, 38% to 36%, and Chelsea won. But when you watch the game, you could quite easily see it could have ended in a draw. In the end, a little bit of magic from Hazard opened the game. Then, of course, Spurs had to attack and they lost 4-2 because of, you know, a defensive error they were trying to make when they had to desperately get a goal. So I think one can put too much emphasis on issues like grudges or injuries. They're just convenient explanations for something that might have happened or might not have done.
Right. Well, I got the impression they were almost paralysed by the importance of the game, to be honest.
Well, the only time they looked paralysed was when Gallas headed the ball up in the air. Yes, it wasn't a great header. It was headed back into a dangerous area. But when you watch the other players, the ball was in the air long enough for three or four of the Tottenham players to go and close it down and get tighter and even get to the ball first before Cahill. But they all stood still. That was the amazing thing. They all stood still. I watched Vertonghen. The ball was up in the air, made no effort to go and close the ball down. They all watched it and Gary Cahill was first, and what a great goal it was from him. Yeah. But it was the lack of urgency, lack of desire from the Tottenham defenders not to get to the ball first.
Well, there's no such thing as lack of desire in a London derby, so yeah. I did feel the whole grudge thing. Matthew, do you think they're being a bit generous towards Tottenham in the studio here?
Well, I think that the most striking thing about the match was Tottenham's incapacity to cope with the really remarkably fluent and attractive attacking trio at Chelsea, Hazard, Oscar and Mata. And Chelsea, you know, for a long time, I mean, under Mourinho, a very pragmatic and utilitarian system of play, something that Roman Abramovich didn't like too much. Under the new manager, I just feel that he has created a new system which, for the neutral, is remarkably attractive. They're very fluid. They change positions, but the intricacy of their passing is magnificent. And I think that Spurs were, I mean, they're not a lot worse than Chelsea. I totally take on board what Danny is saying, but I do think that Chelsea were marvellous.
In his post-match press conference, Di Matteo said, "What's changed is our attitude. We go away and play with the same attitude we have at home. We take the initiative," which I think that's a remarkable statement, don't you, Danny? I mean, this is a team that's so confident that they're prepared to play away from home at a big club. Yes. As if they're at home.
I'll tell you what altered that game. It was Arjen Robben's penalty for Bayern Munich. When he missed that penalty and Chelsea won the European Cup, the result was they were able to buy Eden Hazard, who otherwise would have gone to Spurs, and his one shot through the gap that got in Mata to score that goal to go 3-2 up, that was the difference. And these little things matter. Chelsea have spent a fortune, and when you spend a fortune, you get more points. There's an iron relationship between money and points, and the relationship is immediate. In other words, there isn't a settling in period, and Oscar and Hazard combining with Mata have demonstrated that clearly. Although no one should forget that Chelsea also had Torres, and although Torres doesn't score as he used to, he really does open up defence. He stretched the Spurs defence over and over again, and that gave Mata and Oscar and Hazard more room to play.
And it's interesting, two of Torres' best games have been against Tottenham, where he didn't score, and against Arsenal. He played really well against Arsenal, kept on threatening the back of Arsenal, and it allowed those players, because what Matthew's saying is those three players behind the main striker, people aren't sure how to pick them up. Do the midfield drop back to pick them up, or do the defenders come out to try and confront them? And that's the problem that Tottenham had on Saturday.
Yeah, and they're also, Chelsea are not just a team with three beautiful playmakers. Their defenders will score goals as well. I mean, they're like Man United, but Man United were at their very best. You didn't know where the goals were coming from, Matthew, did you?
Yeah, I just think that they are an all-round splendid lineup, and I find it difficult to say that with so many things about Chelsea not to like, from the owner down to some of the players and their behaviour. But I think that one has to, as it were, segment in one's mind one's feeling about the philosophy of the football club and the money that bankrolls it on the one hand, and the quality that they are bringing to bear on the pitch on the other. I mean, I think Danny makes a really important point as well, that money is deeply significant here, and when you spend a great deal of money, you're likely to get results. And I think, I don't know if I've got this exactly right, 85% of the variation in points is explained just by wage differences, and of course they spend a lot more on wages, probably double, more than double what Spurs spend. But nevertheless, the aesthetic and the dynamic that they've brought to this season, I do think there's a watershed in the way that they are approaching their football matches tactically and technically.
It varies a bit at the top, Matthew, so it's a curve with which sort of flattens off at the top. You have to spend a huge amount more money in order to gain an advantage between Chelsea and Manchester City because they're both spending vast fortunes, but you can spend a lot less money and achieve exactly the result you're suggesting between Chelsea and Spurs. And clearly you could watch the money on the pitch, you could watch what Hazard did, but it wasn't, of course, just about having the money. It was also about being able to buy the players you wanted, and what did that was winning the European Cup.
What do we think about AVB? I mean, I love the shot of him scribbling at 2-3 down. I mean, I've never seen anyone take so many notes so intently.
I'm never sure why. I was in coaching for several years. I'm never sure why managers and coaches take notes down. If you can't remember what you're going to say at the end of the game, or you can't remember what you're going to say at half time, then you've got a slight problem. As a coach, at half time, I'd have 3 or 4 points that I was going to make, because players can't take any more than 3 or 4 points, and it's no good trying to change everything. So you have 3 or 4 really good points that you want to make at half time. That's all you need to say. The only time I can see managers scribbling down is if they play a man marking system at set plays and they're about to make a substitution and they have to write down who's going to be marking who, which I don't agree with anyway.
Yeah, but he wasn't writing a diagram, he was writing a novel, wasn't he?
I think that when we talk about bringing up children, we always talk about nurture versus nature, and my view is that providing you don't actually shut your child in a cupboard and not give them any food, nurture, the differences between two good parents in nurture don't make much difference. And the same's true of managers. AVB at Chelsea essentially shut the baby in the cupboard. You know, it was hopeless management, and therefore he achieved a bad result. Most of the time, it doesn't make much difference. Harry Redknapp's impact on Spurs is overrated. When he took over Spurs, there was no way they were going to finish in a bottom three. When they finished in the top, it wasn't because of some dramatic change in their ability, but because they'd actually just managed to do almost the opposite of what they'd managed to do before. In other words, get within that random fluctuation right at the top rather than right at the bottom. So I think people overstate the impact of managers. At Chelsea, AVB was hopeless, but that was an exception rather than what generally happens. And I suspect with Spurs, he's just doing perfectly well. And for Spurs to lose to Chelsea, well, you know, it's not that unexpected.
Matthew, I mean, the fans overall didn't take to him. Is he going to win them over?
I think it'll go with the results. The narrative always follows the results rather than the other way around. But I agree and disagree with Danny. I agree that managers, the variation in their quality is not hugely dramatic in changing results. In other words, we tend to overemphasize the importance of managers unless they go and start shooting their players or locking them in cupboards. I totally agree with that. But I disagree with them about parenting. I think that and I say this as a new father, no, actually not really, more based on the science, that the level of, I mean, the concept of heritability is important here, but when it comes to, for example, playing well at sport, the variation that you get from different children based on the parenting they have is absolutely dramatic.
Should we subvert this program and turn it into a sort of biology game? I can see Alison looking more and more concerned as the subject slowly drifts away from AVB towards a discussion of whether Steven Pinker was right in his book, The Blank Slate.
Yeah, exactly. I'd be more than happy to talk about how brilliant my children are at football, but we won't. We'll move on instead to Loftus Road. Well, I mean, I'm not actually sure that Everton could have done much more to make sure that this could have been the moment where Mark Hughes got his first win of the season. They were without Fellaini, who, as we all know, has been one of the stars of the early part of the season. Player sent off, and they looked a bit below par. Well, quite a bit below par, I think, on the whole. But still, despite and they let QPR score an early goal, but they could not get the win. So the big question is, why not? That's played 8-1 non. Why not, Matthew?
Well, I mean, it may well be, as Mark Hughes argues after every single match in his interviews with the BBC, that they've just been rather unlucky. I mean, they certainly played a lot of the top teams so far, so it may well be the case that this is something that they will overcome and improve and get better. But I do think it's quite worrying when you look at the defensive frailty. I mean, often they are just all over the place, and that may be something which is going wrong in terms of the way that Hughes is running the training sessions, but for somebody from looking the outside in, that seems to be their most conspicuous weakness.
And Mark Hughes has always based his game plan around good defences. When he went to Blackburn, yeah, when he was manager of Wales, when he went to Fulham, the first thing he tried to base it around was a defensive policy and to be hard to beat. And that doesn't seem to be the case with QPR. They're too easy to play through. They're too easy to play. I'm not sure how much work Mark Hughes and his coaching staff are doing with the defensive strategy. I think they do a lot of work in terms of their mental side. You've got to be hard to beat, but you have to do the work. It's no coincidence that the best defences have always been the ones that have worked day in, day out on the training field, squeezing a high line, dropping off at the right times. And from what I can see, Mark Hughes certainly isn't doing that with the side he's got out there at the moment.
But why would you not do that?
Well, I could say the same. Arsene Wenger never did it until this season, because he believed that his side could pass it and be better than the opposition, and he didn't. I still don't think he can read situations when balls are played in. He doesn't know how to coach it, and that's, I think, a problem with a lot of coaches in this country. The sports science has taken over from the tactical side of the game and the coaching of the game.
We can eliminate from our inquiries the idea that it's because QPR are playing difficult sides, because, you know, the think tank looks at how they're doing compared to how they should be doing at this stage, given who their opponents were, and they're bottom of the table in terms of the team against expectations. In other words, they've lost more points against the number of points we expected them to win by this point in the season than any other side, and they're also bottom using any other method you use to adjust for their fixture list at the beginning of the season. So clearly they are in some trouble. There is, of course, a chance that he's right and it is bad luck. And, you know, Chow and I once said, when asked about the French Revolution, him, what do you think of it? And he said, it's too soon to tell. Well, it's certainly too soon to tell at this point whether this is a permanent problem. And they were facing an Everton, because Everton had done everything else, agreed to see them lose, but they were facing an Everton, a very good side. Everton, I think people don't appreciate, are either fifth or sixth, depending on how you look at the measure, in terms of top sides, and they're particularly good defensively. So they were playing a very tough side. Admittedly, somebody got sent off, and all that rubbish about, you know, you're better off with 10 men is nonsense, otherwise everyone would play with 10 men, wouldn't they? So they clearly were in a bad situation. You know, they're doing very poorly this season, and obviously you do want to look at the training methods, I suppose.
And it was one of those games where we had a relatively new referee to the Premier League, Mr. Moss, and he was blasted by both managers. Any justification for those rather harsh words from the managers towards the referee, Matthew? I mean, there were penalty shouts, and the sending off was a little laughable, would you agree?
Yes, I felt tremendous. I felt, I guess, like everybody watching, how on earth did Pienaar get sent off? I mean, the second yellow card, there was no contact between the two players, so it seemed incredibly harsh. Having said that, when one watched it in real time, and when one thinks of where Mr. Moss, the newest referee, was and his line of sight, it did look as if Pienaar had tripped his opponent. And so my sympathies a little bit are with the ref. In fact, on Match of the Day 2 last night, both Shearer and Mick McCarthy said that when they watched it on the telly in real time, they thought that he should go, he should get a red card. So it's exceptionally difficult as a referee, and they don't get a huge amount of help from the various technologies that could be there to support them. The two penalties, I thought, were wrong as well. I mean, both of those penalties, I think, should have been given. So it was all round a bad day for Mr. Moss, but one has to feel a bit of sympathy with him, as with referees more generally. I mean, they have one particular line of sight to a situation happening in real time, and then we get the opportunity to deconstruct it from all sorts of different angles in slow motion and so on afterwards. But you can understand Moyes' frustration, that's for sure.
You're absolutely right, Matthew, in terms of the referees don't get any credit. They're put under a lot of pressure. And it's one of my bugbears nowadays. When you see managers on the side, what do they influence most in a game? They don't influence the tactics. They don't influence their own players. Their whole reason for being on the side of the pitch seems to be to influence the fourth official, the assistant referee, and the referee. You know, and I go back to Arsene Wenger again. He stands on the side. In the last 5 years, I've hardly ever seen him come out and give any directions to his team. Or any tactical directions. All he ever does is moan at the fourth official, talk about time wasting and try and affect the referee. And most managers are exactly the same.
And it may work. I mean,
it does work. That's the problem.
I mean, when you looked at the really odd phenomenon of home advantage, which is significant, very statistically significant in football, that could well be channeled through referees and trying to harness their various cognitive biases, whether through the crowd or the manager. So you can understand why they do it, and you know, it may well have an effect.
Danny, you were very polite about Everton. Do you feel that, I mean, they're still unbeaten, a top-notch work ethic. Do you feel that they'll be as happy as they've been for decades going into the big derby match?
They ought to be. And when you try to look at the sort of relationship between points and wage bills, and then you map managers against them, where you would expect them to be compared to where they are, one or two managers consistently finish above that curve. Alex Ferguson does. Sam Allardyce does, actually, which is why it was bizarre when clubs sacked Sam Allardyce. But the other person who finishes season after season ahead of that curve is David Moyes. And the Everton's performance at this point is now not that unexpected by the think tank. We would expect them to be doing this well.
Because you factor in his...
Well, because by this point, the history of the club, when you look at the shot, when you take shots on target and their goals and you feed it into a model, you find that they're right up there. When you look at a model which compares salaries with that position, they're nowhere near. So it is an extraordinary achievement, in particular in defence.
But Moyes does have trouble with the Merseyside derby. How does... I mean, he does. Even when he's in previous seasons when he's been in a similar situation, everyone's saying, wow, aren't Everton doing well? He still wobbles in the derby. Is it going to be different?
Well, playing Liverpool's quite hard. I mean, one of the things one of the other sides that are right up near the top are Liverpool. So naturally speaking, they'll have more difficulty in the Merseyside double than they'll have against Stoke. But this isn't because it's a derby. There is a little bit of evidence that derbies produce more draws. So the form, this idea of the form book flies out of the window in derby games, it does fly out of the window, but not that far. It sort of falls over the windowsill and out the window. And the truth is, if you looked at any side that...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Faces Liverpool will have a mixed picture because Liverpool are quite good.
Let's have predictions for the Merseyside derby. Stuart.
I think it's going to be a draw. I'm going to sit on the fence. I think it would be a draw.
It's always silly to be asked about a figure, so I always say 1-1 because that's always statistically the most likely score.
Matthew.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the probability, the think tank. I'll go for a draw as well. And just throw this in. I mean, fascinating what Danny says about certain managers consistently operating above that correlation between wages and performance, in that along with Ferguson and Allardyce, Moyes has done this year in, year out. I mean, that just trying to abstract from all the different bits of subjectivity that tend to influence football all the time, that sounds to me like the most shut, you know, open and shut case for Moyes getting one of the really biggest teams in Europe. And I just wonder whether, has the think tank done any work on international managers, people who are operating in European leagues, La Liga, the Bundesliga and so on? Are there any others who are operating consistently above
that
trend
line? No, it's difficult to do. You have to do it when you've got the data. One of the things that I should say, incidentally, is it may be Everton that's finishing above there. We don't know that it's David Moyes. You have to hypothesise that it is. I mean, it obviously is Everton, but he's their manager, so you assume that it is.
It's the kit man.
But it may be the culture. It may be the culture of the club. And it also may be the ability of a team on a certain amount of wages to attract good players. Because Everton have got a history, people may go there. So it could be to do with that.
But did it predate Moyes' tenure, or does the data not exist for that?
No, data. We didn't do data that long ago.
And at one point, Everton was spending big money, weren't they? In the 80s, when they were the top side, they could go and buy the best players and the biggest players. But the one thing I would say about Moyes at the moment, he's developed his game plan in recent times. Everton are playing the best football they've played, as well as being hard to beat, as well as being aggressive. They're now playing some creative football in the top third of the field, and that's the making of a good team. If you can defend well, you can be organised, but also create in the top third. Moyes has got it right at the moment.
So it doesn't sound like anyone here thinks that they're a one-man team, because without Fellaini they didn't look
I don't think that. It's fairly rare for managers to make much difference, in my view. On average, they don't make any difference at all. But it may just possibly be that David Moyes is an exception to that, as AVB was in the other direction.
So to the big debate. This weekend we're supposed to start a week-long campaign by Kick It Out. Players were supposed to wear t-shirts saying one game, one community. Who could argue with that? But no. And I can't tell you how many players didn't wear the shirt, because at some clubs the shirts, they ran out of them, and at some clubs it was too hot for them to wear them as a layer over their training shirt. But it was started by Jason Roberts. He said, Kick It Out are not doing enough and I'm going to show my displeasure by not wearing the T-shirt this week. So, the question is, does Jason Roberts have a point? Is the Kick It Out campaign a little weak? Is it funded by, because it's funded by the FA and the Premier League and the PFA, is it limited in what it can do? Stuart.
It is limited in what it can do, and I'm not sure that Jason Roberts, you've got to give everybody the chance to say what they feel or and do what they like, but I don't think it was any benefit for the campaign at all. I don't think he's did the right thing. Is he doing it for his own benefit and his own publicity? That was something that came into my head when I was listening to it. Oh, he's somebody that likes the media, somebody that has a view and has a place on in the media, and I wondered if he was just trying to make that a bit more prominent.
Well, being a bit attention.
Yes, there we are. That's you've said it. I didn't.
Danny.
Well, I took my son to his first game. He looked at me and he said, "Daddy, I thought you said we were playing Spurs." And I said, "Yes, we are." And he said, "Why does that sign say Chelsea against racism?" the truth is that the Kick It Out campaign has had success. And if you look at Chelsea versus Spurs, you can see it. The League Cup final, the Carling Cup final between Chelsea and Spurs was a very unpleasant occasion for a Jewish Chelsea fan because the anti-Semitism was appalling. But the Kick It Out campaign has tried to deal with that, and the games between Chelsea and Spurs have become somewhat better as a result of that. And you do feel this. So I think that Jason Roberts and Rio Ferdinand are undermining a campaign that works, so I don't agree with them about it. However, at the same time, I do think they've got a right to express their opinion. And I think it is foolish for Sir Alex Ferguson to start to tell Rio Ferdinand what he should think about it. I think Rio Ferdinand is wrong. I think that that for the Ferdinand family to keep on with the point where they've now taken it to court, the FA has ruled, the FA has suspended somebody, there's been a fine. You know, at this point, I think I personally think that they're trying to press something on and on, you know, and Rio Ferdinand has his own disciplinary problems with the FA and expected understanding when he did those things. So I don't agree with him, but the one thing I would say is he does have the right to hold that view, even though I don't think it's very constructive.
Matthew?
I think it's definitely true they had the right to express an opinion. I think it would be abhorrent if either a football club or the Premier League or a football manager imposed their political views upon the players who were not therefore allowed to make a particular protest. I mean, this had nothing to do specifically with football. It was a question of how best to demonstrate their sentiment about anti-racism. And the perspective that Ferdinand and Roberts were trying to portray is they think that the institution Kick It Out is not doing as much as it otherwise could do. Now, are they right in that opinion? I think that what is clear is their stance gave the anti-racism campaign far more publicity over the last 48 hours than it would have done had they gone along with the wearing of the T-shirts. And I think they highlight quite an important point, or two important points. One is that just because an organisation has a particular goal that we all want to agree with, in other words, getting rid of racism, are they actually doing the right thing in their approach? And I think that they're absolutely entitled and probably quite right to say they could go further. They could have been more strenuous in criticising the hypocrisy of Chelsea, who ban fans for life for racism, but have only keeping the armband with John Terry. I think they're right to say that the FA should have more punitive sanctions for people who are convicted by an independent panel of indulging in racist abuse. I mean, I think all of these perspectives are absolutely, absolutely valid, and I think they've had far more publicity than they would have done had they worn the T-shirts.
But could a more strident and outspoken campaign work within the confines of football? I mean, I think I do feel the Kick It Out campaign have to sort of almost tiptoe through the various really quite often toxic issues, because it's not an easy entity, football, in which I really would never have expected anyone connected with Kick It Out to really slate Chelsea for allowing John Terry to wear the armband in future. I mean, Danny, do you agree? We'd be aghast, wouldn't we, if they did that? This is a lobby group. It's not...
Yeah, they've got... I would have been surprised if they did do it. I think that Chelsea's position with relation to John Terry, and I say this sadly as a Chelsea fan, is untenable for the reasons that Matthew suggested. If anyone said that as a on the terrace, they would be thrown out. Chelsea's position until John Terry failed to appeal was that he didn't say it, or he didn't say it in that context, and now the FA has ruled that that was not the case. And I think if Chelsea are going to accept the rule of the FA, they have to accept that. And I know Chelsea fan wants that to be the case, but you know, you've got to hold to some political principles even when you're watching football, however hard that may be for me to accept, because I try to divide those things. That's almost the whole point of watching football. But you can't really divide it here. And I think Chelsea did have to act, and they didn't.
Why do you think they didn't?
Well, because I think they didn't for one stupid practical reason, which is I think they'd find it very hard to know who should be captain. They don't want to play Frank Lampard every week, but they wouldn't want to pass him over for the captaincy. I'm sure that was a major reason why they didn't do it, because it would cause practical difficulty. And also, one of the things people fail to appreciate in politics sometimes, when people don't resign, they're all friends together. They work together. They are on his side against the FAs. There'll be one of the ways you create teams, as Stuart will tell us, is by embattling.
And I've been on a few shows in the last week or so, and they've had Chelsea supporters on there, you know, from the Chelsea Supporters Club and whatever they were. And they will defend John Terry till the hilt. You know, they would say, yeah, well, he did say it, but he was actually, he was not guilty in a court of law, you know, and you can't condemn what he's done for Chelsea, and for that reason, he should be captain. They're still not getting the point, most of the Chelsea fans. They still believe that John Terry is their leader, he's a great character, all these sort of things, and it's Anton Ferdinand that was in the wrong.
But add to this the fact that these people are sharing a dressing room. For them, John Terry is not, as he is for me, somebody who I watch on the pitch. He's a real person with whom they work every day. And of course, I used to experience this when working in politics for the Prime Minister. Somebody would get involved in a scandal, and you would go to them and say, the Sun and the News of the World needs a response on the scandal, and they'd say, I didn't do it. And even though you know the evidence is they did do it, this is someone you work with, and it's very hard to say, well, I think you're lying. Yeah. And I'm sure that's the problem they've got as well. You know, John Terry, to the people at Chelsea, he's not a newspaper article. He's a real person.
And unfortunately, football doesn't. If the player is valuable to the club, they do everything they can to protect him. You know, and I go back to Arsenal, Tony Adams. You know, if it had been another player who'd been put in jail for drunk driving, they'd have got rid of him. Tony Adams, they supported him, and he came back as their club captain again. You know, if a player is valuable to the club, they'd do everything to protect
them.
But
it's almost seen as character building that they've gone through the crisis in the first place.
And then they're held up as heroes.
But Jason Roberts, I don't know if he's being self-serving, and I think he has the right to not wear what he doesn't want to wear. But what disappointed me a little, Matthew, was that he said he will now speak to Kick It Out, and he will talk about them getting more money. I think that's going off on the wrong tangent. It's not about money necessarily. It might be about where your money comes from. It's not about having more money. It's about having the guts to when it says kick it out, they mean kick. They don't just mean push gently.
Yeah, and I agree with you about that. And I think it is fascinating. I mean, two things. Firstly, picking up on what Danny said earlier, the context here is worth noting, which is that football was a recruiting ground for the far right in the 70s and 80s. You know, Danny, as a Jewish man, has been on the receiving end of anti-Semitism as a mixed race, half Pakistani Brit. I have heard really nasty chants that have made me feel deeply uncomfortable in football stands, you know, 15, 20 years ago. The situation has improved, and I think that the anti-racism authorities and the FA and the Premier League and the players and the fans who police a lot of this in the stands, who would turn around and berate somebody who used racist terminology or epithets, I think that is something to really celebrate. It's rather wonderful that the argument at the moment is just how zero tolerance we should be, just how punitive the sanctions should be. It's not a question of whether sanctions are necessary. The question is how punitive should they be. And no one would dispute the fact that Terry's four-match ban is just one tiny bit of the retribution he's going to face. I mean, this is going to stay with him for a very long time, because the cultural expectation in this country is that somebody who has been convicted by an independent panel of racially abusing someone is unlikely to get a really top job in the media or whatever after his career ends. I think that's rather wonderful. I mean, on Jason Roberts, I don't know him well enough. I mean, I have spoke to him a few times. He seems like quite a principled chap, and it's probably a good thing that he's meeting with Kick It Out, so that he and Ferdinand and all the others who have deep concerns about how punitive the sanctions should be and other issues of that kind, they get a chance to air their views.
But it's Abramovich's new style, which is Chelsea aren't going to kick it out, they're going to pass it out from defence.
But it's, I think if we go to have a final word on this, it's a shame. The campaign this week was supposed to be not just about how black players are treated at grounds. It was supposed to be about making sure that people from the Asian community and women and disabled groups are felt welcome at their local club, and it's about the community aspect. And that's been completely... people say, oh, it's raised awareness. It hasn't, actually. It's meant that people are not discussing all the other things that can be done to make football clubs part of the community, Stuart.
Absolutely right. And again, I was on a show recently, and I said, well, when I was a player, one of the players that is very much has been a part of the anti-racism campaign called me a white so-and-so twice on the football field. I've never brought that up, and I wouldn't say who it was, but it's got to work both ways, you know, and that's something that we don't hear about, and you know, it's not just kick racism out, it's kick everything out of football. Yeah. Abuse, you know, and there's too much abuse from the terraces. I sit and stand sometimes and look at people, you know, 50, 60 year olds almost having a heart attack, the abuse they're giving players when Ashley Cole comes back to Arsenal. I just don't understand that mentality.
I try sitting in the stands shouting, this is regression to the mean, but no one joins in the chant.
No, I love that. But you know, you said, Alison, that the debate over racism has obscured some of the other debates that might happen about inclusivity in football, or maybe not racism have obscured it, but these other debates haven't actually happened. I think that's a valid point, but I think it is very interesting culturally that football, above almost anything else in society, has been a vehicle to debate big moral issues. Racism, privacy, nationalism, all of these things, almost all of the back pages on a Monday are moral issues rather than technical, tactical issues about the game as it's played on the pitch. I think football does provide something of a cultural service in allowing those debates to happen in a very wide range in a broad way.
Now time for some of our quick hits. Edin Dzeko said, I will never be a super sub. But that's precisely what he has become, isn't it, Danny?
A year ago, we ranked him 19th in the whole of Europe. Now he's 106th, and that's all down to playing time. So yes, he's right to think he's become a super sub. I wonder how long he'll put up with it.
Dave Jones called Leeds fans vile animals after their abusive chanting and the assault on Chris Kirkland. Matthew, do you have sympathy with the Wednesday manager?
I have huge sympathy. The behaviour was despicable. The chants that rained down on Dave Jones were hateful. And in the heat of the moment, you can understand why he said what he did. But I think it is unfair, very unfair, to characterise all Leeds fans in that way. I think it was a tiny minority.
Stuart, is it onwards and upwards for Norwich now they have their first win of the season?
Well, they played well against Arsenal, but I've also seen them play poorly this season, particularly against Liverpool at home. I think they're going to struggle this season. They work hard in midfield. They've got a defence that, again, doesn't seem to be that well organised. They're going to rely on Holt for goals. I'm not sure he's going to score them.
Two happy managers after the Weir Tyne derby. But which boss should be the happiest, Danny?
Sunderland had a 34% chance of winning. Newcastle had a 36% chance of winning. 1-1 was the most likely score, 13% chance. So essentially, they both had expected value of points won. They got 1 point. Neither of them should be happy. Neither of them should be unhappy.
Wow.
Brilliant.
Can you come on every week, please? United's front three are starting to click, Matthew, and Chelsea look pretty awesome. So, when they meet this coming weekend, are we seeing a title decider?
Too early to describe it as a title decider at this stage of the season, but two terrific teams. Chelsea, incredibly impressive this season, and I think it will be a fantastic match.
Stuart, West Ham came up via the playoffs and look extremely comfortable in seventh place. How come?
Well, they've settled on a style of play. I think Allardyce, when last season, was unsure with the fans how he wanted to play. Now he's made it clear they're going to get the ball forward early. They've got Andy Carroll to win balls in the air. They've got midfield players supporting and winning the knockdowns. And then they're being creative in the top third of the field. And they're defending much better. So it's a good start for West Ham. I think they can keep in the top half, but it's going to be a struggle for them. But they're going to rely on Andy Carroll to win enough balls in the air and get their midfield players in and around the knockdowns. Alison, here's one for you. You were at Craven Cottage on Saturday. What should Paul Lambert do with Darren Bent?
Well, I think he should keep him. I don't think they're going to recoup anything like the £18 million that Villa paid out for him in the first place. And I think it's a chance for Lambert to show that, yeah, we all know he's good with young players. Can he cope with what is a relative superstar at Villa? He claims they get on famously, have a laugh together, that he dropped him, but it doesn't mean there's an issue there. He can score goals. Let's see if he can get the best out of him. That's it for this week. I enjoyed it enormously. Thanks for your company. It's been great fun. Come and find us on Twitter, or you could email us at gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. Join us next week, of course, because we'll be looking at the Merseyside derby, and I think Liverpool are going to win that for what it's worth. And there's a cracker of a match at Stamford Bridge to discuss as well. Don't forget to go to thetimes.co.uk for news, gossip, and, of course, the best analysis. So I'm back to my stamp collecting. Goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.